I am Plante on the line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. I've never been to Port Hardy, which is a coastal village at the north end of Vancouver Island, but a new book takes us to this place surrounded by rugged land and raging seas, and to the mid-20th century at that. And it's a memoir of the writer Michel Drouin's boyhood in this wilderness that shapes his life. You see a coastal village on the brink of an industrial boom, what with the forestry industry, not to mention fishing and later mining. It's a unique childhood, and it's BC history. The full title of the book is Past the End of the Road, a North Island Boyhood. Michel Drouin was a high school correspondent for the North Island Gazette. After graduation, he worked in the forestry and fishing industries until he was hired in 1990 as an assistant editor of the United Fishermen and Allied Workers Union newspaper, The Fisherman. He joined me last week from his home here in Vancouver. This new book is from Harbor Publishing. Please welcome to the Plante Online program, Michel Drouin. Mr. Drouin, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Thanks for joining us. I enjoyed this book a great deal because your gift of storytelling really comes through. If you had to say, guess where that came from, by the way, were your mother and father, were they great storytellers?
My dad was. The funny thing was, even when he was working, or when he after he retired, you know, I'd go visit him in Port Hardy where he lived, and sometimes I would sit around with him for 3 days, and we'd drink beer and just look at the fireplace, and then once in a while, suddenly he'd just sort of launch into a tale of he had a photographic memory of all of his aunts and uncles and where they had originated and where they had moved to, and I guess it just stuck.
Yeah.
But I was a really avid reader as a child too, and I don't know if it happened deliberately or what. If you don't mind me rambling, my wife actually accused me of losing my storytelling style when I worked as a journalist for 28 years,
yeah.
from 1990 to 2018. And she says, you know what? She says, your writing was much more was livelier before you became a journalist. So I'm delighted. I'm delighted to hear that you tell me that storytelling, folksy storytelling, is still there.
Well, what did your wife think of the book?
She said, boy, you were a real criminal, weren't you? I had a touch of juvenile delinquency in my history. Otherwise, well, she knew the David story, and she was,
yeah.
She said, and I didn't use the real names there. And she said, why did you do that? And I said, well, there are still family members of that family alive, and people not from Port Hardy will read that, and of course they won't know the family history. But it was a major tragedy that in a small town it affects everyone. So I mostly used real names, but I used a few created names. For example, in the chapter about starting school,
yeah,
there was a little girl that came from quite a poor family and peed in the sandbox, right?
Yeah.
And I did not use her real name, and I was so happy because I was doing a reading in a Vancouver Island community, and one of her brothers came up to me and said, oh, hi, do you remember me? I'm so-and-so. And I was so grateful that I had not used the real name because, you know, here's a living member of that family, and if I had used the real name in that case, it would have been embarrassing for everybody all around.
Yeah, I noticed the kid that, you know, you mentioned your juvenile delinquency, the kid that you were hanging out with, the kid with the Beatles album.
Yeah.
You didn't use his name at all, did you?
I called him Randy, but it's not his real name.
Yeah. You mentioned David, and, you know, this is what's really great about your book, is that the marvelous, charming, lovely moments about a kid growing up, but then there are also these accidents, you know, these tragic, horrific accidents, you know, because of the workplace, because of the kind of work that the folks there in Port Hardy did, you know, whether it was in forestry or fisheries, mining. I wonder, as a kid, what did you make of you know, these these tragic deaths that you would have to encounter, David's wife especially, you know. Do you think that affects one? I guess it affects one a little more when it's in a small community like that, right?
Yeah, well, the young fella who, like I described, was a real spark plug, you know. Like, he was only 22 or 23 years old. He already had three businesses going,
yeah.
And he was a very skilled blogger, and through some stupid move by somebody, it was never really clearly determined. He died tragically under a load of logs, and they were it affected me. That young couple were neighbors. We lived next door in these little houses right on the shore in Port Hardy, and when him and Jeannie were first married, and then they had their first child, they were close, and my dad and him and me used to go hunting in the bush together, and so I was close to him, you know. And then I got a little bit older. They had three kids in quick succession. I was old enough to go babysitting if they wanted to go out.
Yeah.
And I babysat for them for about possibly not even 6 months, because I was 12, and I guess I was a fairly responsible kid before I went bad.
Yeah.
and so I babysat for them, and then boom, he was killed, you know, and that affected the community and. In many ways, because the young widow took up with my best friend's dad, and then that shattered that family,
yeah.
and then my friend and his brothers and sister and mom left Port Hardy. So yeah, the whole thing was sort of a cascading domino effect of tragic and disturbing consequences.
Yeah, when you were a kid. And because you described the book, you know, as a free-range sort of child-rearing that you had.
Yeah.
A lot of time outdoors. When you look at how kids are today, I mean, does that upset you in terms of how, you know, kids don't spend as much time outdoors as they should, say?
Oh, yeah. I feel like parents are so overly protective, you know, and you know, they hear in the news about child abductions and et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And they seem to be scared of people using drugs, so I don't think, in my opinion, people with drug problems don't usually run around abusing the children, you know.
Yeah,
sure. My daughter moved to, believe it or not, Berlin, Germany, and lives in a city of 7 or 8 million people, and my 17 and 20-year-old grandchildren sit around with their noses in their cell phones, and they always have. You know, their whole lives, they have rarely actually gone outside and experienced the kind of things that I did. Last summer, I was fortunate enough to take my grandson off into the bush camping one night,
yeah.
in the bush on the Duffy Lake Road, and I don't think he'd ever done that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. As you write in the book, it wasn't until you went to Montreal that you saw, you know, what was outside your world, if you will.
Yeah.
When you were a younger kid and you were in Port Hardy and you were in this small town, did you wonder what was outside, say, the, you know, what was happening in the big city? Did you want to live anywhere else?
Oh, I don't think I wanted to live anywhere else. I paid attention to the world news. So
yeah.
I don't know why I always say we got television just in time to see Kennedy shot and the Beatles on TV.
Mm.
1963. And then I remember when Kennedy was shot, and we were got let out of school at 10 a.m. and we're all walking around the schoolyard. And I remember this girl whose parents were English said, "I don't know what we're going to do now. We've only got Churchill left."
Mm.
And even as a 10-year-old, I thought, I paid attention to the news. I said, no, the Prime Minister is Lester B. Pearson. Or, I can't remember, maybe it was Diefenbaker at the time, you know.
Yeah.
Or haven't you heard of Charles de Gaulle? You know, it was like, somehow or the other, I'd been aware of the wider, broader world. And I knew a little bit because we had spent the summer in Quebec, the summer before 1962. So,
yeah.
You know, I'd been on a jet plane, I'd been in Montreal, but we sort of went from one small town to the other. We went from Port Hardy, where I like I said, either the rest of it, I was out in the bay with a rowboat or wandering up a river, watching spawning salmon, or in the woods building log cabins. And I spent the summer at my grandpa's farm where he was still mowing hay with a horse, and he had just got a brand new electric milk pumping machine, but we went and stayed in the house my mother had grown up in. So it was like from one small town to another, you know, with a quick glimpse of Vancouver and Montreal on the way.
Yeah. So was it in high school when you first seriously thought about writing professionally?
Yeah. There was something in me that wanted to do something different, and I had an idea. I wanted to get involved in video production, actually. Mm. And even in sea cadets briefly, I bailed out of there because I couldn't stand getting haircuts and shining boots and marching. But one of the officers, one of the adults, he was almost acting like a high school counselor. You know, he said, "What are you interested in, Michelle? What do you really want to do?" And I said, "Oh, you know what? I think television production would be cool." And he said, "Oh, you know, when you graduate, you had to look into Ryerson Tech in Ontario. They do that." This was the early days of, you know, not like today. Yeah. You know, to consider being involved in film or in video was a big deal. But I considered that, but then I started scribbling for the North Island Gazette, and I'd always read. And I think, like I mentioned in the book, at the end of the introduction, a lot of the stories I told, I could have told, well, had already occurred before I was 18.
Sure.
I didn't have the writing chops, of course. I mean, I could put a few words together because I was writing a column for the high school for 3 years, but I just didn't have the retrospective view that you do at 70 that I had at 18, right?
Yeah. But it's funny you mentioned television production. I didn't know that even after reading the book. That comes through just how visual you are in terms of your description and your writing, which is what makes the book so enjoyable. Just you capture so much in your writing. I feel like I'm there and I've met these people. Like so many memorable characters. Well, what is it like, Michelle, when you're writing this book and you're remembering? You know, a lot of the people that you encountered growing up were older than you were, and, you know, have been gone for a while now.
Yeah.
As you're mining your memory, what is it like living with those memories and all the people that you knew, you hung out with?
Oh, it's like being there again.
Yeah.
I think I was fortunate. I don't know if I have a talent for it or what. You know, the first one, a lot of people whom I encountered last week have said, "Michelle, how can you remember all that stuff?"
Yeah.
You know, in the description about fishing salmon with my dad, describing how the gear works, for example, I spoke to a bunch of people in Campbell River on Tuesday, and I apologized afterwards, and I said, "Listen, I knew one guy was a professional troller in the crowd, and I said, you know, I'm sorry if I got anything wrong. You got to remember, these are the recollections of an 11-year-old. And he didn't have a word of criticism of how the power takeoff came off of the engine and how the power went to the girdies and the spools and the cannonballs and the snaps and the hoochies and the spoons and the flashes. He said, "I got it right." So, but yeah, well, they didn't. I hung out with my dad, and he'd go to, he liked to drink a little bit, sometimes a lot of bit. And there was a nearby neighbor who was the fella in the logging store who had lost a leg in an accident, and they made him a foreman of an isolated logging camp, and he just had no leadership qualities other than sort of directing a small crew on a side hill. He didn't know how to manage a camp, so I think they had to let him go. But that guy, he was just a few doors down, and I would go there. I'd follow my dad, and I'd just sit around and listen to the adults BS.
Yeah.
And I guess I absorbed it, and they didn't realize that I was a little thesis operative. I mean, I was just recording everything in my little brain, you know, and a lot of it continued to come back.
Yeah, they're memorable. Another memorable character in the book, Einar Johnson.
Yeah.
I liked reading about him. You mentioned Gary Ewert earlier. The young man who died. There was a story about Bill, who it's just a fascinating story about how you knew him growing up, and then later on you ended up in Mexico on a vacation, and Bill was there, and another guy from Port Hardy, right?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, these really colorful characters and memorable characters. I'm sure you remember, as we're talking, their faces and how they walked and what they looked like, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. These are the really special people that make up a small community, and that's why you remember them, and that's why they're so memorable for the reader. What was it like getting along with people in a small town like that? Because everybody knew everybody's business.
Yeah.
Did you find that? I guess when you grow up in it's you're used to it. But I mean, you live in Vancouver now. When you see what it's like in a city and what it's like in a small town like that, it's different, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, my dad had good friends, mostly amongst the Haywire crowd.
Mm-hmm.
And there were some more established families there, some that dated back to the earliest settlements. And then there were others who'd come there in the 30s. And some of them were kind of snooty and arrogant towards newcomers. You know, my parents got there in 1953. And there were a handful of families that sort of continued to act almost as if they were the nobility in the town and the rest of us were peasants. And my dad felt that deeply. There were a few people that he really didn't like. I think I may have mentioned it in the book when there was this guy who tried to get him busted for poaching, for using the wrong kind of gun, shooting a deer.
Yeah.
And so he didn't like that guy ever, you know, ever after that guy sort of tried to rat him out to the game warden, and he was innocent of any wrongdoing, right? He didn't like that, and he felt that deeply.
Yeah, they were in the same hospital at one point, right up to the end, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And he told you that he didn't like the guy's guts.
That's right. Yeah, right to the very end. Yeah. And then, personally, I had a lot of good friends amongst the white kids,
mm-hmm.
but some once in a while, there's a little bit of, sort of, for some reason, anti-French prejudice would come out, and it'd be, you know, a lot of people, they called me Frenchy, or make fun of my name because they'd say it was a girl's name and stuff. And then I'd ride my bike out to the... I'll say it. We called it the Indian Reserve in those days. That's what it was called. I'd ride my bike out to the res, as we say now.
Mm-hmm.
And those kids were just so open and welcoming. You know, I saw a couple of them in Port Hardy on Wednesday, and I knew enough of the language to say hi. You know, in Kwakwaka, and they said, "Yeah, how are you?" And I said, "Yeah, fine," like in their language. And I wish I'd learned more, but I was grateful that at least I learned that, you know. And when I see these guys, I can still greet them in their own language.
Yeah. So you obviously had a good relationship with the indigenous. What was it like for the other people, like the other people in Port Hardy? Did they mix at all?
A lot of the men worked in the woods.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd see each other in the store, but... No, there wasn't too much social interaction. There were a handful. There were some families that were partially indigenous,
I see.
And they were blended into the community. One of the earliest settlers, one of the earliest white guys. I think he was an American, but he may have been an American of Scottish origin,
uh-huh.
And he met. A bunch of people from the Kwakiutl tribe band, or whatever it's called, at a world fair in Chicago. And then he was, because they had gone on some sort of big international world fair, sort of exhibition of Aboriginal culture. They went on a dance troupe all the way to Chicago, and he was hired to accompany them back to British Columbia. Well, he liked Fort Rupert so much, he married one of the Aboriginal women, and he started a whole dynasty. And so the guy that owned the primary business in town, the gas station, car dealership, was was one of his sons, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so there was that. There was that kind of blending occasionally, but not so much. There wasn't really a heck of a lot of intermarriage, for example, you know, amongst my parents' generation, amongst my friends. I know one of my dad's colleagues in the logging camp had an Aboriginal wife, and it was kind of considered kind of unusual, actually.
Yeah. You also illustrate just how isolating it is. I'm sure there's a dentist now in Port Hardy, but when you were growing up, there wasn't. And so, you know, you show us what when you had a toothache, what you had to do, and you know, you hoped it was just an infection, so the doctor there could just give you an antibiotic. But if it was a lot more serious, you'd have to go into town, wouldn't you? Or go would you go to Vancouver, or where would you go if you had something serious in terms of your dental care?
Oh, dental care, you had to go, you pretty much had to go south. Emergency, just anything short of a fatal injury, they'd send you to Alert Bay, because in the wartime, you know, Port Hardy had a hospital. They had a hospital for the air base that was established in 1942, and after the war, that hospital was put on floats and taken to Alert Bay, because Alert Bay was a more central. It was sort of within air transport, a fast airplane trip from Port Hardy. It was right. Alert Bay was a big fishing community with an Aboriginal community. The logging community of Port McNeill was just across the water, as was the basically Finnish fishing logging community. And in those days, the whole coast was dotted with little logging camps. So Alert Bay was central. Yeah. And as it turned out, the doctor there actually had his own plane for a while. So if you were, you know, if you were injured in a logging camp, if it didn't kill you, you'd end up in Alert Bay Hospital.
Yeah.
And so that's what my dad had, his collarbone broken on the job in 1955 when he fell in between a couple logs and the logs squished together on his shoulders. And he ended up in Alert Bay Hospital.
Yeah.
And he always told me this story. He said if it wasn't for the guy in the next bed, he would have starved to death because he couldn't move his arms, but the guy in the next, but they just plopped a tray of food in front of him and walk away. So the guy in the next bed fed him.
Yeah. There are a number of stories about the times you spent on your father's boat, Seagull. The way you describe it, I can see it in my mind what it looks like. And he used to fish as part of the fishery too, using that boat, right?
Yeah, for 5 years.
Yeah. Did he make a lot of money?
Oh no, it was. No, it wasn't a big money fishery. He just enjoyed fishing so much.
Yeah.
He thought he'd try it commercially, but I don't really explain it too clearly in the book. But at the end of 64, I think it was, or beginning of 65, he got that job up at the Nuwiti River Logging Camp.
Uh-huh.
And the old Seagull needed to be pumped out every day, and he just wasn't going to be home to do that. And so he sold it to a couple of guys from BC Tel who did not pay attention to it. It wasn't very long before they let it sink at the top.
Yeah, I was just wondering how much fish, say, you know, on a busy run, could a Seagull hold?
Oh, you know, we never even used the main hold. He just fished enough to fill up. I kept up with just the lockers that were on deck. So, you know, it'd be a big landing if he had 100.
Yeah, and there's a scene in the book where he has to gut the fish and then throw the insides back into the water and then the fish into the storage locker, right?
Yes, correct.
Except that one time when you were asking too many questions.
Yeah, that's probably the favorite thing for the whole audience whenever I read it.
Yeah.
And he never forgave me. He told me that story for the next 20 years. but we didn't have to hold the fish for long because we tied up at fish camps, and there were isolated little fish camps all over the coast in those days. And they were mobile fish camps. They were on floats, and they had an ice machine and a little store, and so you could day fish out of them, you know, and get up before daybreak, go out fishing in the nearby waters, come back at dark, and the buyer would be there, and they'd unload you, and if you had ice and not too many fish, I guess you could keep the fish for a day and go back fishing again until you had a load. And then they had ice there, and you could unload and get fresh ice and get some groceries and go back out again.
Yeah, and so you did that with your father. You also worked with him in logging.
Yeah.
When you were a kid, I guess it was inevitable that you would go into one of these businesses, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. For a lot of kids, that's the same thing, isn't it? They did the job that their dad did, right?
Uh-huh.
Did you get involved with mining at all? Because there was a mine there at one point, right?
No, I could easily have gotten a job at the mine there, but I'd already trained as a boom man. I knew how to do that. I helped my dad out. First off, I did that in the summer when I was 12, so I knew basically the routine. And then when I was in high school, if he was busy on the weekend and his second boom man was away, I'd go help him out on the weekend. So I just kind of fell into that as a first career. I didn't want to go to the mine. I figured being on a boat on the water, shoving logs around and being creative and making every log boom was kind of different. It was like putting a puzzle together, you know. I figured it was much more interesting than even driving a great big mine truck up and down out of a hole.
Yeah. And the mine eventually closed, right?
That's correct.
Yeah. This is illustrative of you know, just what a resource place this place was, Port Hardy.
Yes.
Was, because you know it has the logging, it has the fishing, and then the mining. You end the book in the 1970s when you and your young family are about to move away from Port Hardy because it's changing, and I guess for you, did you feel like you didn't see a future there, you just wanted to leave, or what was the reason why you left?
There was no sort of land available at the time. You know, my wife and I were young, idealistic 23-year-olds. I guess we were 24 by the time we left. We wanted to go somewhere where we could buy an acre of land and grow a garden and build a cabin of our own.
Mm-hmm.
And Malcolm Island nearby had been settled by the Finns initially, I think, in 1902. And so there were established farms there. We didn't have the money to buy a farm, but there was still old farms, and this American couple we knew were subdividing their back 40, their literal back 40, and so we bought 10 acres of that. And it was forested, but we knew we could knock some trees down and build a cabin and a garden. And there just wasn't that kind of property available in Port Hardy. It was just either waterfront or it was real bush, and nobody had old farms that they were subdividing.
And it was changing, wasn't it? It was very different than at that point.
Yeah, it was sort of a Wild West mining town, and to be frank, my wife was from Europe, and she never liked the place anyway. And it was not the little town I had grown up in that I had told her about.
Yeah.
You know, we got to Port Hardy and the mine was booming, and there were some pretty rough people from basically all over the world there, and the beer parlor culture was the height of that was the most cultural thing in town.
Yeah, it's a fascinating thing. As you see the patterns of say migration into Port Hardy, the sort of people that it attracts or draws in.
Yeah.
And that changes with every industry, doesn't it?
Yeah, but as if you just read the book, you'll notice that a former producer from CBC's, you know, This Hour Has 7 Days, ended up driving a pump truck at the mine.
Yeah.
And this fellow, I didn't name him, but his name was Robert, and he had been Pierre Trudeau's hairdresser. He ran a diamond trail, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So just a fascinating part. So the book ends there in the 1970s as you and your wife, your young family, move on. There's obviously more to your life and your story. I couldn't help but think there's another book in you. Is there?
Uh, I have about 65,000 words down about the stump ranching life.
Uh-huh.
I don't call it homesteading because technically homesteading is what the government offered free property in exchange for people moving onto it. You know, at the prior to the turn of the century, and I think the government canceled that in the early 70s when they realized they would have a whole bunch of hippies moving out into the bush claiming property if they didn't cancel the Homesteading Act.
Yeah.
So we had to, you had to earn money and buy property, and that's what we wanted to do. And yeah, I have a collection of stories that are almost a book about that, and then over the years I've worked on so many fish boats. I think it's close to 30 boats by now.
Mm-hmm.
I have a collection of stories called Boats I've Worked On. There's a couple of near sinkings and some amusing anecdotes in there, and I'm always working on stuff.
Yeah, it's just I can see, you know, another book, and as you just described, another book after that, because your gift for storytelling is right there, and you make learning about these people and these situations you found yourself in over there so fascinating to read. So you live in Vancouver now. How long have you lived in Vancouver?
Since 1986.
I see. And
yeah,
the education
system was failing us up there on Malcolm Island. It was the Socred restraint era, and teachers would get sick, move on, get pregnant, take time off. And they wouldn't replace teachers, and parents were coming in and volunteering, and good on them for it, but they weren't teachers. And you know, when my daughter came home from school one day, we asked, "What are you doing? What did you do today?" She said, "Oh, we painted rocks."
Yeah.
And then I had a job on a fish boat. I never really got on any really good fish boats, but I was on one good fish boat, and we had a really good season one year. We had some money in the bank, and I was eligible for UIC, as we called it in those days,
yeah.
Employment insurance. And my wife said, "You know what? We've got money in the bank. You're eligible for EI. Let's go to town and try it out for a year and put Jessica in a school where she'll actually learn something." And that was in 1986. We're still here.
Michelle, I so enjoyed the book and have enjoyed talking to you today. Congratulations on it and continued good luck. I can't wait to read the next one and the one after that.
Oh, thank you so much. Wonderful.
Thanks.
To hear that.
The book is called Past the End of the Road, A North Island Boyhood. It's from Harbor Publishing. It's author Michelle Drouin. Join me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunta.